Well, we don't have, I don't know any kind of results that would substantiate this. I forgot to mention it's very sandy soil, and most probably there are very few minerals that are left unweathered. It's probably feldspars and sand-sized or silt-sized feldspars and muscovite, micas that are present there. So I don't think the pressure would be involved, but definitely changes from, water content over time can be involved for micas, definitely.
Thank you very much, Philippe. Lots to think about in terms of genetic implications and management implications that come to mind as you went through your findings. The next talk will transition a little bit further into the rhizosphere now, into the microbial realm. And during our planning session, I deferred to Tom Ducey for suggestions on who a good rhizosphere microbiologist might contribute to this session. And he says, well, why don't you just look down the hallway, Tara Sullivan. So I didn't choose her, but I was glad to hear that because I actually co-teach a course with her on soil-plant microbial relationships starting next fall again. So I was glad to see her come to the top of the list. And so Tara joined us just a few years ago, and she got her PhD at Cornell and her BS and master's at Colorado State. And so her emphasis is looking at the phylogeny of the soil microbiome, and she has a special interest in metal availability in the rhizosphere. So she'll talk about some of that work. Tara? Oh, there you are. Oh, and then for the nutrient management CEU, I've got a list here. I'll put it back on the table and you can sign up.
Thank you, everyone, for coming this afternoon, and thank you to the organizers and presiders for inviting me. I'm incredibly honored to be here. I feel like my career is somewhat neonatal, so I'm up against some of the other scientists here. I'm very appreciative to be here today, and I actually think that the sequence of talks has been, I actually really appreciate that a lot. I feel like we went from structural discussions of the rhizosphere into some biogeochemistry discussions of the rhizosphere, and this is the part where I get to tell you that it's all the microbes. Microbes are doing everything, right, because I have this microbe-centric way of viewing the world. I'm not really used to not being able to see the screen, so I'll try not to stare at the screen in front of me. But yes, that's what we're here to talk about right now, is how microorganisms control or may be controlling metals and micronutrient availability in the rhizosphere. And so I'm going to start off, I think we've had some great definitions of kind of what exactly is the rhizosphere, where is the rhizosphere, some important factors of the rhizosphere and what's going on there. But what I'd like to start with is sort of a quick primer about what we know about microorganisms in the rhizosphere and things like signaling in the rhizosphere. So Hinzinger was kind enough to talk about a lot of the chemical things that are happening in the rhizosphere. So things we know when it comes to microorganisms and root interactions is that roots are constantly exuding different compounds into the rhizosphere, both actively and passively. So we know there are proteins, mucilage, root tip cells, phenolics, sugars, attractants specific to certain microbial groups, flavonoids that are also specific signaling molecules for specific microbial groups, even organic acids, as Hinzinger talked about, actually acidifying the rhizosphere in order to gain their own nutrients from that limited zone of depletion around the root. But the roots can also exude repellents into the rhizosphere, both for other plants as well as for microorganisms and pathogens. While at the same time, microorganisms are undergoing the same types of chemical signaling. While they're excreting quorum-sensing molecules so they can sense the number of other organisms that are in their environment along the root, they're also excreting their own extracellular enzymes to acquire nutrients from their environment, as well as antimicrobials to depress pathogens, And even phytohormones that can stimulate plant growth, and siderophores and other metal chelating compounds like organic acids. So we know that this chemical interplay is highly dynamic over space and time, not only along the axis of the root as the root grows through the soil, but also having to do with the physiology of the plant, the species of the plant, the season, and the time of day. All these things can change in both quantity and quality. So we know that because of this interplay, this dynamic interaction and communication between the plants and the microorganisms, we know that within the rhizosphere, microbial functions can lead to enhanced biomass production both above and below ground. We know, especially from some recent studies with the poplar microbiome, there are some specific plant growth promoting rhizobacteria that can dramatically increase and enhance root architecture and root tissue cultures. We know that certain microorganisms can provide drought protection as well as gene regulation within the plant itself. We also know that certain microorganisms in the rhizosphere can provide pathogen protection, even individual plants, but also across entire landscapes. There can be the development of suppressive soils where the microbial community literally suppresses certain diseases. We know that certain rhizosphere microorganisms can enhance crop yield, increase crop quality, and a lot of that has to do with increasing nutrient availability. Nitrogen, phosphorus, iron have all sort of been discussed. And this is huge when it comes to both increasing and decreasing metal toxicity or metal bioavailability in the rhizosphere. And I was actually, I have to give credit to my collaborator, Joan Davenport, for this highly complex root image that you're looking at here. I was like, we're going to have so many wonderful root images. And this was actually a photo that was taken by one of Joan's graduate students of a Concord grape brooding system. Literally just exhumed it, you know, the shovelomics, if you will, and took a photo. But all I want to emphasize here is that these microbes in the rhizosphere are providing these very essential ecosystem functions and services that wouldn't necessarily be capable with or would happen without the microbial community. But again, my focus is on the metals and micronutrients. So there's always a lot of discussion of biogeochemistry at meetings like this. We talk a lot about carbon, and we talk a lot about nitrogen, and we talk about climate change, and that's all very fair. But my viewpoint is on metals and micronutrients. And you may be like, well, why are these even important to us? And I love to show the periodic table. Because all those blue squares are metals. It's huge when it comes to crustal abundance of elements, the actual elements that the plants and the microorganisms are exposed to and have to deal with literally every day and to survive. And not only that, but a lot of those metals are actually macro and micronutrients. And there's a list here. I'm going to test you afterwards on this list. No. But they're extremely important in virtually every metabolic function that microorganisms and plants go through. For instance, photosynthesis wouldn't occur without manganese. Nitrogen fixation wouldn't proceed without molybdenum and iron and sometimes vanadium. So metals are extremely important just for metabolism, but there's this gray area, this sort of catch-22, the fact that while metals and micronutrients are absolutely essential to life, with too much of them in the extracellular environment, they become toxic. So you're walking this fine line of needing something that can also be toxic to your cell. So this brings us to this idea of what we deal with all nutrients, right? The total amount of nutrient, and in this case metals, that's present in your extracellular environment does not equate what is bioavailable or readily uptakeable. Just coined that phrase. So when we talk about bioavailability, specifically with metals, primarily we're talking about ionic potential. And ionic potential is the combination of the ionic charge as well as the ionic size of the metal itself. And so this diagram here is just to illustrate the fact that there are suites of metals and certain charges of metals that have certain binding efficiencies, certain binding affinities, and preferred ligands in the environment. And so those suites of metals will react in similar ways in the environment, will react in similar ways to ligands and chelating molecules. So what I propose in my own research is that these groups of metals that behave somewhat similarly in the environment, so they may have similar charge, size, or ionic potential, microorganisms have developed transformation mechanisms to deal with these metals. And in some cases, these mechanisms can be somewhat promiscuous within that group of metals that actually behave similarly in the environment. So microorganisms have evolved these multipurpose metabolites, these ligands, chelators, organic acids, and metallophores, and specifically siderophores. And if we can understand how microorganisms can enhance or decrease the bioavailability of the metal, then we can move forward in terms of understanding crop nutrition and even toxicant removal. So this is actually a diagram out of a bioremediation paper from 2010, just to demonstrate the fact that there are a suite of microbial exudates, including organic acids, chelating molecules, metallophores, and siderophores, that can serve a number of different functions within the rhizosphere, both enhancing metal availability or precipitating out certain metals out of soil solution to detoxify those metals, while at the same time, many siderophores are also encapsulated with quorum sensing molecules. So not only are they acquiring nutrients from the environment, but they're actually signaling to other organisms in the rhizosphere about their numbers and their capabilities at any given time. We also know that plants have developed a similar strategy when it comes to iron acquisition. Iron is a constant struggle for all living organisms because it's readily abundant but not bioavailable. We know there are strategy 1 and strategy 2 plants, and strategy 2 plants have secreted or developed their own phytosiderophores. So not only have they actually developed the biosynthetic pathways to create these metal chelating molecules, highly specific for iron, but they've also developed the pathways, the receptor proteins on their cells' membranes to actually take up that metal chelator complex into the plant, and they can literally translocate the siderophore metal complex all the way up into the leaf tissues. So they're already set up for cross-kingdom communication when it comes to siderophore and metal chelator uptake. So this provides the basis for where I'm coming from when I think about my research. If we can understand these mechanisms, these microbial controls on metal bioavailability in the environment, specifically in the rhizosphere and in soils, we have the capability for two very important functions in our environment. One would be to increase crop quality, production, and nutrition, while at the same time, understanding those mechanisms may also allow us to actually enhance bioremediation and understand effective contaminant removal and control of metals specifically. So there's been a bit of a paradigm shift where I think we're undergoing a paradigm shift right now when it comes to big data and being able to very cheaply sequence a genome. High-throughput sequencing has allowed OTU generation to become extremely accessible, extremely affordable. You can sequence an entire microbial genome in just a few weeks. You can assemble the contigs and annotate that genome and have it in a metabolic model literally within weeks. So this has really opened up the door for the types of studies that we can do on microbial communities, microbial individuals, microbial function, but it's primarily in silico right now that this is all changing. We are even being able to recently get better at phylogeny by pair-ending the reads for things like an aluminum iSeq, so we get larger contigs. Or rather, there are larger amplicons that lead to larger contigs. And then there's also the advance of the genomes, metagenomes for whole communities, transcriptomics like RNA-seq, and even metabolomics. But these community-level analyses, when it comes to the actual function, specifically how are the whole community, how is that impacting the plant and the micronutrient uptake, those analyses are still fairly limited in terms of being able to target certain microorganisms and their specific functions. So that leads me to my research framework and what I aim to do, which is to use these tools that are rapidly developing, genomics, metagenomics, and even gene expression, but combine that with a whole lot of lab studies, greenhouse studies, and things like that, where we're actually measuring ligand production, siderophore production, measuring metal bioavailability, and throwing that all into a computational framework when comparing that to what we see in plant response, what we, and this is where the collaborators come into play, right, where we look at nutrient uptake, yield and quality, stress resistance, and even signaling in the rhizosphere, and we combine all these things so that we eventually come up with a combined or unified framework that allows us to look at microbiome from a phylogenetic point of view, but that this will also inform the function. So as we look at the phylogeny, we will have a better understanding of the function of that community, of that entire consortia or consortium, and how that will then affect plant resistance, resilience, and response. So basically, since I've been at WSU, I've been trying to begin the very first few steps of applying this research framework in a very, hopefully, multifaceted and multidisciplinary approach on two major projects. I have some others that are coming up that I'll talk about in just a second. But these two projects are literally at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of what the problem is and how we are trying to approach it using this framework. So the first problem you're looking at on the left side of the screen is Concord iron chlorosis. Now, iron chlorosis is something that affects many perennial crops and also other grapes, not just Concord grapes, but wine grapes as well. This is a problem that affects primarily the south central region of Washington, where they have these calcareous sandy soils, so the pH is fairly high, iron availability is fairly low. They are irrigated crops, and again, like I said, this chlorosis can affect a series, quite a few different types of perennial crops that grow in these types of soils. And these zones of chlorosis, as you can see in the photo, will appear in a vineyard and will repeat year after year after year. They can apply iron chelates, but that typically only ameliorates the problem for that year, and those aren't allowed in organic systems anyways. This other problem here on the right side of the screen, again, the opposite end of the spectrum, we're dealing with the Palouse throughout eastern Washington and northern Idaho, where we have silt loam soils. They were less deposited, extremely friable soils, so a lot of the growers have gone to no-till, low-till, conservation tillage, but they do band their nitrogen fertilizers in a zone just below the seeding zone. And these are dryland cropping systems, and what you're actually looking at here is an SEM of a wheat root tip that's undergoing aluminum toxicity. The aluminum actually literally clogs the calcium channels in the root, so it doesn't even necessarily get translocated all the way up into the shoots, but it leads to a whole series of other problems. So again, this problem, as I arrived, I always think of this picture when I think of the Palouse. I moved to the Palouse from Tennessee where there were trees, and this is what the Palouse looks like. It's beautiful in its own right, but when deposited soils give you this sort of sand dune look, these soils, when they were initially deposited, were circumneutral and supported grassland-type ecosystems, were immediately taken under agricultural cultivation, and over the last 50 years or so, due to the excessive use of nitrogen fertilizers, we've seen the pH begin to drop from circumneutral to, in some cases, we're measuring as low as 4. And as Hinzinger mentioned, if you know anything about soil chemistry, a drop of 2 pH units is really huge. Now, these soils are actually structurally made of aluminum. It's an actual part of the structure of the soil. So as the pH drops, they exhibit pH-dependent aluminum solubility, meaning the aluminum actually comes into solution as the pH drops. So that's why we're having aluminum toxicity. But as the aluminum increases, the pH decreases, you get magnesium and calcium deficiencies and aluminum and magnesium toxicities. And this is particularly important for the leguminous crops because, as Hinzinger mentioned, they tend to also acidify their rhizosphere, but in addition to that, they have to have things like molybdenum for the nitrogenase enzyme complex to work correctly, and molybdenum becomes completely unbioavailable below pH roughly 5. So the legumes seem to be suffering a lot. So as I arrived at WSU, my initial goals were to sort of characterize the problems, understand the implications on the microbial community, and then begin to apply this research framework to understand how we can manage this rhizosphere community to benefit or protect from the aluminum toxicity. So I was really fortunate to be able to work with Dave Huggins and his graduate student, Carol McFarland, with the USDA. They had initiated the study where they were sampling in 2-centimeter increments to actually characterize the stratification of these soils. And so we did, of course, see, so what you're looking at is primarily I just want you to see that the pH drops dramatically from the surface soils to the subsurface soils, which we only sampled down to 10 centimeters here. We did apply 2 different types of lime. So there was a sugar beet lime and a liquid lime, Excuse me, and you do see some effect of the liming in the first few centimeters, but by the time you get below the 4 to 6 centimeter depth, roughly, there was no statistical difference. So the pH is still, we're looking at 4.5 there. At the same time, we were interested in how the aluminum was behaving in the same shallow sort of rooting depth, but in these very refined depth increments. And we saw that in that fertilizer banding zone was where we were seeing, regardless of treatment, we were seeing the peak in aluminum concentrations. And so this led us to hypothesize, and I have to give my postdoc credit for this figure. He actually created this himself. So his name is Rick Lewis, and I'll talk more about him in just a moment. But we hypothesized, so what you're looking at here is on the left-hand side is what the happy wheat plant growing in a circumneutral soil, very active mycorrhizosphere, lots of beneficial bacteria, lots of nutrients available, and basically things performing in a different way is what you see on the right side of the diagram, which is where you have your lower pH, you have basically a stressed plant where you have a lot of aluminum coming into solution, an altered root exudate profile, and a completely altered structure and function of the microbial community that would normally be associated with these wheat roots. And so in order to start to test that, we came in and initially just looked at that, again, that stratified sampling system, and looked at, are there any differences that we can detect in the composition of the microbial community just with those small depths? We didn't see a treatment effect in the first 2 years of this study, but we saw a strong pH effect, as well as both measured aluminum and modeled aluminum in Visual Mintec. Which led us to more questions about how is that changing, how is that impacting crops. And so the pulse crops, like I said, are impacted the most by the aluminum in the soils. So you can see a clear relationship between the measured aluminum and the biomass of the chickpeas, but also the biomass of the lentils present at these sites. And again, you're looking, like, for instance, on this x-axis, you're looking at aluminum concentrations that went up to 120 ppm. That's a whole lot of aluminum in soil solution. And then literally last night, my postdoc actually emailed me the microbiome data, and it was too much to try to get into this talk. I would love to share it with you, but he came up with some great bar graphs for me, but they were a little bit complicated. So, but what is clear from those bar graphs is, so we took the surface layer, the middle layer, and then the bottom layer, the 8 to 10 centimeters, and simply looked at 6CNS, so bacterial diversity, in order to get at, are these rhizobial communities impacted, what other aspects of the bacterial community are affected. And the one thing you can see from the billions of colors in these bar charts that he sent me was there's much greater diversity and much more even species diversity in those surface layers that have been treated with lime versus with depth, what you start to see is more dominance of very specific taxa. By the time you get to the really high aluminum concentrations at depth, it's dominated by two or three taxa, even in the complexity of these graphs that he sent me. And so I'm really excited to get home and really dive into that more and maybe get some network analyses going on. And maybe next year I will talk to you all about that data. So then the next steps there, once we sort of characterize what we think is sort of going on with the acidity, it's definitely impacting the communities and the crops, is to then apply this framework in two different ways. One is there are still parts of the Palouse that have not been cropped and still have circumneutral pH. And then there are, of course, the lowered pH systems. But our wheat breeders have done a great job at developing wheat genotypes that are both aluminum tolerant, and then comparing those to the susceptible varieties. So in running through quickly through the framework, we have a whole series of experiments set up now where we'll be comparing both native soils to acidified soils, doing some rhizobox experiments, looking at the tolerant versus susceptible genotypes, looking specifically at siderophore biosynthesis under each of these different conditions, and then targeting those organisms that are secreting the siderophores for further analysis, things like RNA-seq and then some qPCR, so look at specific genes associated with siderophore synthesis, and then being able to take those organisms, those exudates and those siderophores, and test those back against the plants, either in the greenhouse or in the field. So our first step in that was to go out and look at both native or uncultivated versus agriculturally acidified. We did some geochip analysis last year. So GeoChip 5 looks at all these different functional genes. Most of the genes are related to metals homeostasis, but some are also basic ecosystem service type genes. And so I had grouped the genes into some of these basic carbon and nitrogen cycling genes. For the most part, all these subsets of genes showed a clear difference between the acidified soils versus the untreated, the acidified soils we're here calling untreated, whereas the native or lime soils have this higher pH, as you can see here. pH is in the middle there. So a whole pH unit lower. And many of these different basic functions followed this same sort of pattern where there was a clear difference that seemed to be related to pH, except for those genes associated with aluminum resistance and homeostasis. Those seemed to be intermixed, no difference between the ecosystems. And there was a lot of discussion with some of my colleagues afterwards about proper gene annotation in the databases, and maybe this was a problem here, and maybe there really were differences, you're just not detecting it because these functional genes aren't annotated properly. So we then took these very same soils and were able to cultivate over 180 different soil isolates, and they all thrived on two different types of aluminum in the lab. In fact, they increased their growth rates as we increased the aluminum in the media. So this raises some really interesting questions about how these microorganisms are dealing with aluminum, and that is going to lead us to some genome sequencing of some of these isolates and looking at gene expression. Another project that is just sort of getting off the ground. Again, this is our high-tech way to take pictures of roots, as you can see there. this is a Concord system. Again, the iron chlorosis problem with Concord grapes is one that affects a lot of perennials and tree fruits. And in some cases, they can actually apply iron chelates, but they either are effective for a very short period of time or they're too expensive. For instance, with these juice grapes, Concord grapes don't have a high value, so you can't go out and apply a lot of chelates because they're very expensive. And so Joan Davenport and I are starting to work together to characterize how the microbiome phylogeny and function may be able to aid in iron nutrition of these plants. So one of the things that a lot of the growers had done was they would go out and take these visual chlorosis rankings. They would literally just look at the leaves of the different plants and mark it down as either chlorotic or healthy on a scale from 0 to 2. Three. And none of these measurements had been actually validated with actual leaf tissue measurements. So in this diagram, we actually measured leaf tissue iron and had a strong significant correlation with what we were seeing visually with leaf tissue iron. And then we were able to actually correlate that with the composition of the microbial community as well. So what you're looking at here is soil samples that were taken from the rhizosphere of healthy vines as well as chlorotic vines, and it was clear that there was a difference according to leaf tissue iron. That's what's that red vector there actually is a measure of leaf tissue iron was actually strongly correlated with the composition of the microbial community in the rhizosphere. So next steps on that project obviously do more, we're headed towards more metagenomics. We're planting cover crops that may actually prime the rhizosphere microbial community to produce more siderophores. We're doing more with leaf tissue and vine vigor, or at least Joan Davenport is. And then we'll be doing more about measuring siderophores, gene expression, and then looking at potential engineering of the microbiome. Briefly, there's just a couple other projects that we're seeing on the horizon. One is looking at microbiome function in bioretention systems. So this is for low-impact development. We're, of course, in the state of Washington on the West Coast. There's a lot of rain. There's a lot of precipitation. And all that brings down into the soils metals and contaminants. And so I'm working with NSF and some other folks on the West Coast to see if we can enhance the filtration possibility within these bioretention systems through microbial activities. I've also begun work with EPA Region 10 to work on the Bunker Hill Superfund site, looking at Lane Marsh specifically and understanding lead bioavailability to plants and migratory waterfowl using the same kind of framework. And generally, in my lab, we work to improve genome annotation through combining in-lab type techniques with cultivation as well as sequencing and testing the different genes for certain functions. And I hope to improve metabolic modeling and understanding the rhizosphere interactions by combining all these different types of techniques. The take-home message, basically, there are a lot of different tools out there. I would strongly encourage that you don't go out and get big data just because you can, and that we need to work harder on bringing the function to the phylogeny components. And so my sort of last thought is that systems biology, which is basically incorporating all these different measurements that we can take and making it more than just the sum of its parts, will become more and more vital with each passing experiment, basically each passing year. And to strive for an integrated understanding of rhizosphere phylogeny and function, especially when it comes to metals and micronutrients in the rhizosphere. So a lot of my research framework happened all along the way throughout my career, so I have a whole lot of people to thank, and I will leave you with that. Any questions? We probably don't have time.